was it? If somebody saw them circling, they'd know something was dead.
Nice one!
Yeah, right. That was a.
Patrick.
Yeah, that's me there. Yeah, there were some tracks. We're going to be playing some tracks that recorded from the gig in the Vic on last month after the Anarchist Book Fair.
That was
Interterrestrials with Noah's Farce. See. So yeah, welcome to Saint Island. It's the 7th of November. This is our Crime and Punishment special. So we're going to have a lot of kind of different interviews covering mostly kind of prison solidarity, but a few different kind of areas. The next interview that we have coming up is with Linda. And Linda was at a meeting that was here in Lark last weekend that was talking about basically opposing the new generation of Titan prisons that are being built in the UK. This is a campaign that is kind of starting, and it's seems to have kind of picked up a great deal of speed at the minute, so it's quite an interesting one to get involved in. They will be having meetings, and there'll be a link to their site off our website, so definitely check that out. So yeah, here's Linda. Alright, Patrick and
Chickpea.
And we're here with Linda.
Hello.
And we're in Lark at a meeting that is being held discussing the prospect of the development of Titan prisons in the UK, but kind of more broadly focusing on kind of prison abolition and prisoner solidarity. So, I mean, briefly, what is your kind of background, Linda?
My background in prisoner solidarity work, I guess I've been involved with various different projects, Books to Prisoners projects, Political Prisoner Calendar, the Certain Days Freedom for Political Prisoner Calendar project, and just a lot, the Queer and Trans Prisoner Solidarity project as well, so just in general sort of pen pal relationships with some prisoners as well, which has been really it's all been a big learning experience, and also I feel like it's a sort of a direct way to actually have links with people that are actually incarcerated or in prison behind bars and things, so it's been meaningful for me.
And have these been mostly political prisoners, or are they just kind of your everyday prisoners?
I've been in touch through various groups. Some have been in touch more with political prisoners, and some have been in touch with social prisoners, although I do feel the dichotomy between social and political prisoners is a bit false. I do think it's important to recognize the way the state uses the laws to repress people that are actively trying to make changes and better our communities, such as the Black Panthers and the San Francisco 8.
Okay, well, I guess a question that maybe the average person out there might have is, why abolish prisons? I mean, surely they're there for a reason.
Yeah, I think that's it's a big question, but I think for me, it comes down to, there's a lot of reasons for abolishing prisons. One is that I don't think they're really effective in sort of the goals that they say that they're set out to do. I don't believe they actually make communities safer. And also, I feel they target certain communities. I think if you take, for example, I believe in the United States, if you're a person of color, a black male of color, you have more chance of going to prison than to university, or just as much chance. So I feel like it's things like that where you just look at the systematic racism and discrimination, the sexism, the homophobia, the transphobia that goes on in prisons. People that are already struggling in society, it sort of re-punishes them. It's kind of a hard thing to articulate in one go, but I think there's so many levels to it, because I think we now take prisons for granted, but prisons are really something that haven't always existed. You know, there's something that we construct, that we make, and so they haven't always been there. Mm-hmm. And there's different ways of administering, of seeking justice in our society, and so I think we really need to look at different alternatives, such as circle justice, you know, where you sort of sit down with the communities, with people that are affected, and you sort of deal with, okay, somebody's done something wrong against somebody else, you know, okay, you stole, I don't know, you were really hungry, so you stole my chocolate bar. So how do you sit down and sort of say, well, you know, you stole my chocolate bar, so I didn't have one, I also went hungry. How do you deal with that to sort of say, like, maybe we all just need more food, you know? Maybe we need a better standard of living. Maybe we don't need to have that kind of situation. So I think prisons fail to sort of deal with those issues, you know, the larger social problems. Like, and I also feel like in the Canadian context and in other contexts as well, prisons and detention centers have been used as a way of genocide against indigenous peoples. It's been used as a tool of colonization. In Canada now, they're trying to pass harsher and harsher laws to imprison more people. And one of the things that Correction Services of Canada, the prison agency, has come out and sort of said, whoa, wait a second, because like this is going to disproportionately affect the indigenous people. So really, it's a tool of the ongoing genocide in which, like, you know, so many hundreds of thousands of people have been killed. Like, it's a tool also of the capitalist state, I believe, that it's a way of sort of managing different people that they consider to be problematic as well. So poor people, people of color, people who maybe don't have their papers in order, you know, people that are trying to immigrate here for a better quality of life. All of these things, you know, these all come together. So it's just a tool for managing people. So.
I mean, one of the things you mentioned there was the notion of circle justice and the justice in the community. But I suppose the thing that would probably be most commonly thrown back at you, I don't know, but would be kind of, what about rapists and paedophiles? I mean,
yeah, I think this is something that comes up a lot when discussing these things, because we see in the media so often that the media really sort of tries to make us afraid and try to sort of really separate sort of like who is in prison and who isn't. But I think there's larger issues in society to deal with, you know, the fact some people have mentioned, you know, the fact that, you know, with all the CCTV and private security companies and all of these things, that we're all in some ways being watched and monitored. So we all sort of live in a sort of a prison in itself, you know. We're all sort of rushing to work to make money so we can pay our rent, pay our bills, so we can sleep and eat and go back to work the next day and be watched on CCTV cameras as we run around doing this, you know. That's a bit problematic, I think. Like, there's a problem there. And I think what happens is when you're talking about prisons and things, there's so many people, because of racism, because of sexism, homophobia, colonialism, you know, all these other things, like class issues, you know, all these other issues, that there's so many people that are in prison that they're not, the communities are suffering as a result, they're suffering as a result. It's not a holistic solution to what's going on in those cases, maybe problems that have arisen. You know, there's so many people to deal with first before we actually get to people that are maybe, you know, to even start to think about, like, how we deal with the pedophiles and the rapists and so on. I do think it is something to take seriously, but I also think there's groups out there that are sort of dealing with those things in a community kind of way. There's groups like Philly's Pissed and Philly Stand Up that are working in communities with survivors of sexual assault and things, or even the people that maybe have perpetrated the sexual assault, to just sort of deal with these issues in a community way. So I feel like people are taking very gutsy steps to try and deal with these issues and tackle these really hard issues, you know, in a way that does not involve the police, unless that is what the survivor wants. So they're really putting the survivor at the focus, as the focal point, which I think is really important.
I mean, to what extent do you think that your views kind of are kind of minority views, and how do you think that that can be, the appeal of them can be broadened out into a society which is obviously kind of very fearful of crime and of terrorism and of kind of various things that land people in prison?
That's interesting, because the views I hold may seem like a minority kind of view, but I feel like most people are sort of worried about basic issues. You know, they're worried about paying their bills. You know, they're worried about being safe when they're walking the streets. They're worried about having good communities, having good relationships with their friends and neighbors, having time for their families and things. I think these are all concerns that plague us all, you know? And, yeah, I guess I feel like the media creates a lot of fear around, you know, crime and personal crime, like knife crime and gun crime, all these things. And granted, there are problems, you know, I will not deny that. But part of the root of those problems is poverty. Part of the root of those problems is the fact that people are in a really rough situation. And I feel most people don't necessarily feel empowered to change those things, whereas the government do things like put more police in, they will be harsher on people, they will put, what are they called, ASBOs, all these kinds of things, you know. They have a lot of tools at their disposal, but yet they really use it to sort of repress a lot of people. I guess what I'm just trying to say is that a lot of people have normal worries about money, just about living in good communities and things, and what the police is doing, what the media trying to scare us with all these things to make us afraid of our neighbors instead of like working together, it just ends up isolating us more. It ends up not looking for holistic solutions to our problems and things, which I really think is the solution to these things.
And I mean, do you have any ideas about how to kind of broaden the appeal of your ideas? I mean, even beyond kind of prisoner solidarity or prison abolition, but the kind of whole project for society and that?
Goodness, that's a big question. I think ultimately we need to start from where we're at, and we need to move forwards in whichever ways we find possible and achievable. I think we need to set realistic goals, but I also think we need to work towards our realistic goals. I also feel that the course that we're on is ultimately going to lead to the extinction of the human race and maybe a death to most of the life on our planet due to pollution and environmental destruction. So while many people may say that these goals are untenable. Like, I really think the alternative is ultimately our own demise. So we have no choice as far as I'm concerned. Pollution and the ongoing growth of capitalism, the increase of disparities between rich and poor, exploitation, all these kinds of things are not things that are actually really sustainable, you know. And so I think, like, it is working on the projects, like, you know, community gardens, food not bombs, you know, trying to end poverty in your community and further afield, you know, all these things, ending racism, ending deportations, all of these kinds of things. I think these are all things that we need to work on, and they're just steps towards the greater solution. I mean, how that will look, how that will actually work, I don't know. I think it will take time, and I think we just need to keep working on it. I mean, I have hope, I have faith in humanity, I have faith that most people are actually good, you know, and I just hope that we can actually do it before we end up polluting ourselves out of air to breathe and things. So,
thank you very much for speaking with us. Do you have any websites or resources that you'd like to direct people to as an end note?
Goodness, I think there's a lot, but I think I just remind people that, you know, the prisoners that are inside now, that are in there for political actions, they're in there for us, they're in there because they've been fighting strong and they're still fighting, and it's important, write a prisoner, just take up a pen and take some pen and paper and write them, drop them a line, it makes their day, and when you get a letter back, it might make your day as well. So it's really important to do those kinds of things. It's like doing your activist homework, so everybody do that. But yeah, just stay strong, keep going, and thanks a lot for your time.
Drink with me by the Wally Hopper. Oh, we'll take a flight of fancy, leave the teepee on the car. Well, there's schizos at the window and the police round and far to save us from our sanity at the Wally Hopper. Coppers round and far to save us from our sanity at the Wally Hopper. Well, we'll take a flight of fancy. We'll leave the teepee on the car. Well, let's get those at the window and fuckers round and far to save us from our sanity at the Wally Ho Ho Bar. Thank you very much. Good night. We've been killing the boys. Fucking lovely to be in the big fucking smoke, even if it is in a different country. I'd rather be in Ireland.
Okay. Yes, yes. Distant Ireland still stumbling around in East London, broadcasting out of Whitechapel. That tune you just heard was Willie Hoax Bar by Kill No Boy. We've also been keeping a very diligent record of some of the new criminal offences that have been introduced by the Labour government in the past 10 years. I think the total number is something like 6,000. I don't know, 6,000 apparently. One of them is under the Natural Environment and Rural Communities Act 2006, it is now illegal to sell a grey squirrel. So, there you go, really. I don't know what to make of that.
This affects us all, man. You know, you can laugh, but, you know, one day
what? Okay. They'll come for our nuts, apparently. Well, the next one we got an interview with Bra, who's a prison activist based in Brighton, and who works for the campaign against prison slavery.
Okay, this is Adam for This Is an Island. I'm here with Casper and with Bra, who's a member of the Anarchist Black Cross based in Brighton, and also a member of the campaign against prison slavery. Can you tell us a bit about how you got involved in this campaign?
I'm a long-term anarchist activist. It's about the age of 15. It's obviously one of the prerequisites of being an anarchist is the idea of prison solidarity and campaigning. The prison can be seen as a microcosm of the state. It's the sharp end of the machinery of the state. It just seemed at the time to be the right thing to do. There was a group in Brighton. I came along, joined up, and that's past 10 years, I suppose. I had been involved in prison campaigning before, prison abolition campaigning before. Anarchist Black Cross is an organisation that stems back to the Russian Revolution, where it's called the Anarchist Red Cross, but had to change its name for fairly obvious reasons. But basically, it supports anarchist and class struggle prisoners, and it campaigns for... around their cases, direct financial support helps them to a certain degree when they come out. Even simple things like writing to prisoners. I mean, prisoners feel very isolated, particularly if they're political. And in today's modern prisons, where, as I said before, sort of class struggle is kind of largely been eliminated because of the structure of the modern day prisons. But, most prisoners really do need to keep in touch with what's going on outside. As far as CAPS goes, for a long time, CAPS was involved in individual campaigns against companies like Wilcodes, who use prisoners to... their subcontractors use prisoners to package goods for them and help hence keep the prices cheap. But, CAPS at the moment is largely a website-based campaign, sort of naming and shaming companies that exploit prisoners for private profit, and involved in lots of freedom of information requests. Most of these companies are very, very embarrassed to be known that they're exploiting prisoners. Not just because of society's largely negative attitude towards prisoners, but because people understand that. They're exploiting prisoners, that's the bottom line, to make profit. The organisation started in 2002, and it was an idea behind from Mark Barnsley, long-term anarchist activist and ex-prisoner. When he was released, he'd been in prison during the changeover, the Strange Ways riots and when the recommendations of the Wolf Report were introduced. And these included something called the Incentives and Earned Privileges Scheme. Basic idea behind that, or what it actually ended up doing was breaking down working class solidarity amongst prisoners by setting them in competition with each other for jobs that would earn them wages. I mean, admittedly, these wages were mere pence an hour compared to what they'd be earning outside. But through the incentive and privileges schemes, they limited prisoners' access to outside funds, and they made things like, for example, smoking was ended up as being an earned privilege. So unless you towed the line, unless you were a good boy or girl, you would not be allowed to smoke, or you wouldn't get extra visits or access to telephones, etc. And it was an obvious campaign for some of my political views to become involved in.
Okay, and what exactly do you mean by prison slavery? I mean, why do you use that term?
Well, basically, prisoners are not allowed to not work. If they don't work, they are effectively punished. They are given an IEP warning. The structure of the incentives and earned privileges scheme is that there are three levels. There's basic, standard and enhanced. And depending on how trustworthy you are, whether you sign up for compulsory drug testing and a whole other gamut of control and restraint measures that the system has brought in, you can earn more money. But if you refuse, you earn nothing at all. If there's no work, you get the unemployed rate, which is £2.50 a week. Basic rate is £4. But as I say, if you refuse to toe the line, if you refuse to take part in the what they term the prison's resettlement regime, then you are punished. They don't punish you under the IEP scheme, but under prison, the 1999 prison rules. But effectively, that's what happened. You can have remission taken away with you, and some prisoners have ended up actually having extra sentence put on top of their what they're due to serve. Since the Labour government got in, they've increasingly pursued the industrial prison model, the prison industrial complex idea that has been pushed heavily in the States, with not just with the building of private prisons by people like GSL and GEO and various other largely American companies. Also, there's a thing called the contract services, and around about 4,000 prisoners in this country work directly for private companies. They're employed by effectively employed by the company. I mean, what happens is that the governor negotiates a contract with these private firms. He then supplies prisoners to workshops that then turn out products for these companies. I mean, it can be anything from slipping birthday cards into cellophane wrappers, or packing screws into little bags, or it can be, in some of the private prisons, it's making double glazing. By and large, in the non-private prison system, the most a prisoner can earn is £22.50 a week, but that is in very, very rare circumstances. Most of them are around. I think the average wage in a prisoner is £9.60. That's for what is now a 32.5-hour week. Was up to 40 hours. And since they've recently, in order to save money, I think to save £63 million a year, the government have cut back on what's called the core week. So from Friday afternoons now, there's no association, there's no education, there's no work, and prisoners are banged up. But they've, in order to sort of stop a bit of some unrest amongst prisoners, instead of cutting back their pay, they've kept the pay the same, just cut back the hours of the workers. So they're now sort of 32.5 hours a week working, most of them.
Okay, so you'd basically argue that this is a form of cheap labour rather than any form of rehabilitation, as some people might see it.
Well, I mean, there isn't much training you can get from learning how to untangle the cables on Virgin Airways Airlines and slip them back into a little plastic bag. Admittedly, some of the more complex jobs do gain give prisoners' expertise, but unfortunately the environment they work in is not very close to the normal working environment they find on the outside. I mean, it's compulsory. They are supervised by prison officers. The discipline is completely different. They have no choice about where they work. You don't get a choice of what job you do. You're assigned the job and that's it. I mean, effectively, it's slavery. I mean, we have a sister organisation in the States also called the Campaign Against Prison Slavery, and they campaign against the 13th Amendment to the US Constitution, which specifically states that that's the one that states a abolition of slavery except for people in incarceration. So, I mean, you know, the similarity is so it's slavery under any other term.
Is your sort of your critique of the prison system one that, I mean, encompasses all prisons? I mean, are you against prisons per se, or would you say that there's ever a possibility of having a kind of just prison system, or is the prison system always predicated on a kind of a form of injustice in a way?
Well, on basic level, if prison ever worked, then it would have done away with itself a long time ago. Prison has always been a part of society in one form or another. It doesn't work. I mean, there are a number of people within society, so-called sociopaths, who probably do need to have to be kept away from the rest of society. But there are far better ways of dealing with people like that. I mean, most people in the prison system in this country, 55% of all crimes committed in this country are associated with drugs. If you look at the figures for social factors within prison, by and large, most people in prison are there because of involvement in drugs. Alcohol plays a great deal of thing. I mean, education, I mean, educational levels. I mean, I'll just read a couple from some figures now. I mean, nearly 50% of all prisoners have a reading age of 11. The numeracy level of 11-year-old is roughly 65% of all prisoners, 82% with a writing age of 11. I mean, 50% of all prisoners do not have the skills required for 96% of all jobs, and about 80% of them don't know how to fill out a job application form. Yet the system is supposedly there to rehabilitate prisoners. I mean, Jack Straw has recently come out and said that, nailed his colours to the mask and said that prison actually really is there to punish people. Rehabilitation is second. But, I mean, if these jobs that they're supposedly supplying for prisoners are there to train them, then why are there so few of them? I mean, I think there's something like, it's only about 33% of all prisoners actually have a job, and most of those, 20% of those, are actually doing things like cleaning the prison. It's pure hypocrisy to say that the prison is there for anything other than punishment. A Freedom of Information answer from the Ministry of Justice, and for one of the just about the first time that I know of, they've actually admitted that the reason why they have all these private companies, contract with all these private companies for contract services, is to effectively subsidise the cost of prisons. They make, I think it's £6.1 million last year directly from private companies for prison work.
All right. Thanks to Bra for fitting us into his very busy schedule. So we're going to go into a live interview now in a second, but I just wanted to inform you of another offence that you may not be aware of that has come in the last 11 years, and that is under the Nuclear Explosions Act. It is now a criminal offence to cause a nuclear explosion. So just in case you had your doubts, we all do. So we're here with Kevin. Right. Now, would you say you're part of the treatment rooms? Would that be?
Yeah, I belong to a collective of artists based in West London called The Treatment Rooms. We specialise in mosaics, community work is how we started with schools and stuff, but it's taken on more of a distinctly political angle with the stuff that we've been doing. The artist whose house it is, Baroness von Reichardt, she was writing to death row prisoners in America as part of a human rights organization invitation that she got, and so we started making mosaics, and one of the mosaics, the first one we did, was a memorial to a friend of hers, Luis Ramirez, who was executed in Texas in 2005. There was a film made about it, and his mother came to unveil it, which is a really moving experience. And we just became more and more involved with writing to prisoners in America. By a long circuitous route, ended up writing to the Angola 3, which is, Angola is the name of a Louisiana state penitentiary, and it had a reputation as one of America's most brutal and bloody prisons. So yes, the treatment rooms is how I got started with all that.
Okay, so could you tell us a bit about the Angola 3 and who they are?
Yeah,
and
for sure.
Why they're significant?
They are Herman Wallace, Albert Woodfox, and Robert King. They were serving short sentences in Angola in the 60s, 70s for robbery. But what's significant about these guys is that they set up the first chapter of a Black Panther Party within an American penitential institution. And it's for this that they were subsequently framed for the murder of a prison guard, Brent Miller. They've been in solitary confinement ever since. Wallace and Woodfox are now in their 37th year in a 9x6 cell. That's not counting the time that they've spent in Camp J, which is a punitive punishment camp, which is a torture block which exists within the prison as well. And one of those, Robert King, he was actually exonerated in 2001 and freed after 29 years in solitary. And he has been campaigning on their behalf since his release. Herman Wallace asked us to write to another prisoner in Angola called Kenny Zulu Whitmore, whose case was completely forgotten, buried by the authorities. Similarly, he was a young man who was framed for his Panther activism, and he was framed with the murder of the mayor of Zachary, which is a small town in Louisiana. And he's in his 34th year of solitary confinement also. And when we started writing to him, he was also in Camp J, which is the punitive block out the back.
So, and Angola prison is quite famous in the United States. As far as I know, it's the prison population there is something like is predominantly African American as well.
Yeah, predominantly. I mean, it was a tobacco plantation in the 1700s. It's worth pointing that out. It was Angola being where the owners thought that the best slaves came from, and that name has stuck. It still really is a plantation to this day. All the people that worked long-term at the prison as wardens and everything, they are all direct descendants of the people who owned the plantation. Now, you're talking about an 18,000-acre farm, which produces over half the state's organic veg, but it's produced by guys on a chain gang at the end of a shotgun. So if you can look at that scenario and tell me what's changed in 250, 300 years, I really can't see, this part of this new neo-slavery. I mean, it's worth $100 million a year, the prison industry there. And it is predominantly Afro-American, that prison population. I've got some figures here. Yeah, it has the highest imprisonment rate in the U.S. It's more than twice their national average. They reckon around three-quarters of its population are black. And most of those, about 90% of those, die there. I mean, they're sent there for life. And,
right.
You know.
And it's quite interesting. I mean, in the U.S., there's been quite some very prominent sort of prisoner activists. I mean, like, I'm thinking of, people like Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Yeah, absolutely.
George Jackson.
Yeah.
And they sort of link their struggles to kind of wider struggles, particularly like civil rights and kind of black liberation struggles. But it also seems to have highlighted a lot of the kind of
injustice about the United States.
Yeah, absolutely. The linking of all these things is really fundamental to it. I really believe that Wallace and Woodfox, and through their Panther ideology, are doing incredible work from the confines of their situation in organizing people worldwide to recognize the same forces of repression. I've got a nice little story about that, actually. You know the Shell to Sea campaign in Rossport? I was on tour recently speaking about A3 and Zulu with Real News, who you probably know as well, video activists, and we were on a tour showing films all over the UK, and I was doing a slideshow and talking about A3. I don't know if you know, recently with the Shell to Sea campaign, there was this fantastic event when some activists engaged the Irish Navy in the waters in $10 blow-up plastic dinghies that they got from Toys R Us and stuff, which is this fantastic sight. And I sent all this stuff into the prison for Wallace and Woodfox and Zulu to look at. And I met some of those activists when I was on tour who were out in those boats, and they'd never heard about the Angola 3 and Zulu and stuff. So they kindly offered, and I've subsequently written to them, and they're all for it, for the renaming of four of their boats, which are going to be renamed Herman Wallace, Albert Woodfox, Robert King, and Kenny Zulu Whitmore. So quite literally, in their names, those activists will be re-engaging at some point in the future with the Irish Navy.
The might of the Irish Navy.
The might of the Irish Navy, yeah. But as a symbolic gesture and as an illustration of what you're talking about linking these things to worldwide struggles, yeah. Mm.
And what do you think is going to be I'm thinking in particularly with the election of Obama recently in the States. I mean, do you think that's going to signal a kind of change in direction, or is there going to be a real move away from the kind of Reagan Bush sort of punitive?
We can but hope. And there's however much faith one can put in the institution of democracy as it appears on our television screens or whatever. You know, the facade of that is one thing, but it's certainly clear to us in the campaigns to get these guys free that we really don't stand a better chance of highlighting. I mean, if America is to have taken this supposedly big step in, you know, saying let's forget that past, forget that racist past, then surely the continued racist incarceration of these activists must surely follow, you know.
Okay. Should we move on and talk about what you're doing in London at the moment, which is accompanying Emery Douglas, who was he the Minister of Culture?
He was Minister of Culture for the Black Panther Party, and Billy X Jennings is over with him as well, and Billy's a fantastic archivist, and they both joined the Oakland chapter of the Panthers at very young ages, and they worked with Cleaver and with Huey. Emery is an artist who does all the art for the Black Panther Party, and used to do so for the newspaper in its early days. And he has an exhibition of his artwork at the Urbis Centre in Manchester, so he came over for that. And he's taken some time to come down to London and meet the activists here. And we've got an event tomorrow at the Tabernacle in West London in Power Square. And there's a number of people speaking. We've got events, stalls, and music. I think Bashy is going to be playing there as well. And that's from 5 p.m. to 9 p.m. And it's £12 on the door. But these are all. It sounds a lot. It is to me. But we're, you know, activists, as you know, everybody's working for nothing, and Sukant Chandan deserves a big mention here. He's brought out this fantastic magazine, and he's organized the Black Panther commemorative collective, and they've funded them to come over at great expense to themselves. So, and same with us, the treatment rooms, anything that we do with our stuff, or any of the mosaics that we sell or artwork that we sell, every single thing gets ploughed back into the legal defence fund for the guys in Angola.
Okay, and what do you think the significance is for people in London for these type of struggles and hearing these types of stories?
The people who build prisons in America and run the services for those prisons, Correctional Corporation of America, I think they're called, I believe they're already operating prisons, about 8 of them or something in this country. And when you consider that they're building prisons, and you added an article earlier about the Titan prisons, you know, they're basically they're going to build the prisons and then decide who they'd like to put in them. And, you know, that's people like you and I, my friend. In California, in America, for instance, the entire prison population, about 80%, I think it is, of people in the Californian prison population are there for possession of a controlled substance, not even intent to supply, you know. And violent criminals count for about 1.8% of all people in prisons there. So they have a great big media outcry that we live in this dangerous society, you know, feeding on the fear factor thing again and demanding that these prisons be built. But really, they're just targeting the poor and underprivileged in society, as prisons have done since their very inception.
And in the UK, I mean, do you see the same kind of racial composition of prison populations? And do you see the same phenomenon of kind of prison activists coming from ethnic minority populations?
I think because they're the people that do tend to be at the sharper end of it. I mean, having said that, you know, I mean, as yourself probably aware, and we've done work with Paddy Hill and Mojo and John McManus's group in Scotland, the Miscarriages of Justice organisation, and the experience of Irish prisoners here in the 60s and 70s and 80s has taught us something about the racial makeup of political prisoners and political activists that emerge from the prisons. In terms of the black population in prisons, I saw a statistic that says that although black people only represent about 3% of the population, they make up nearly 16% of the prison population. So you start to piece all these things together, and these huge Titan prisons that they want to build, you know, I mean, let's hope they remain empty white elephants, you know.
Okay, thank you very much, Kevin. I think we'll be moving into a track.
But just to mention that Kevin will be our DJ tonight, so do you want to...
I'm in tribute to Barack Obama, and I'm going to play a selection of soul and funk music later, which a lot of it comes from New Orleans, and it's for the fellas in Angola, and there'll be a few other dedications in there for people. But in the spirit of, you know, I keep seeing Martin Luther King on my telly this week, but it does also remind me that, as Mumia Abu-Jamal said from his prison cell, he said he'd like to praise the brother Curtis Mayfield, whose sweet rebel songs kept us going through the days and nights. And I'll be playing a few Curtis tracks later, and I'm going to be paying tribute to the whole soul and funk thing with Panther Music.
Nice one.
Look forward to it.
Wasn't even material strictly speaking. I was 4 foot tall with a 3 foot my Asian. I fucked off school, bought some tattooing. You get punk for that, I brought my arm with a safety pin. I was sleeping in a basket, selling a big issue. But this ain't no soft stories, I don't reach for the tissue. Cause these Spanish punks, they took me under their wing. I was a squatting cap and coming in. These places fucking huge, I couldn't believe my luck. But it was no stranger to the odd rock. Sharing a room in this local champion, writing deep in the world's worst breath. But we had such a time graphing up all the walls. Nations are flying when the occasion cool. Drinking red wine and coke, playing our music loud. On a shitty old same player, we sounded proud. Yeah, we should see if we had a landlord from the top of the stairs. Yeah, we could live it forever without. We were tight, all coppers are bastards, but we were white. Painting our leather jackets, soaping up our hair. We look like aliens out of anywhere. If the toys wanted a photo, we were charged with a pound. When we had enough, we bought a bottle and passed it around. A bag of cheap glue, we got stick picks of pics. And whatever we could find, we're falling into
to give me all his hand-me-downs. He had a great big heart, but he done too much crime. Yes, there he's looking out for me, make sure I was alright. When Alan and the bigger ones got in a fight, we used to see if we had the landlord from the top of the stairs. Yeah, we could live it forever without a care. So let's have the landlord from the top of the stairs. We'll live like a man. The tramps in Piccadilly told me Aaron had died. My head spun around till I sat on the curb and cried. I found myself sitting on Puff's begging patch. When I had seen him around, I prayed he'd lose the match. Now I was in prison and he was the sensible one. Don't let the bastards grind you down, mate, our time ain't begun. Don't let the screws get in your head and fuck you up. Cause when you get out, we'll string that landlord up.
Hi, this is Patrick here for Distant Island, and I am talking with Flo.
Hello. Fumble. Alright, here we go, another random law. It is illegal to disturb a pack of eggs without permission. Disturb in what way? That's what I want to know.
Well, apparently, the majority of the new laws that have been brought in under the Labour government have been brought in by DEFRA. It's kind of like the EPA in the Simpsons movie. but while I have the mic here, I'm going to introduce one of our new segments here, which is the Prisoner of the Month thing. So these are all going to be prisoners that kind of have asked for people to write to them, basically. And the one this month is Sean Kirtley, who is an animal rights campaigner involved in anti-vivisection campaigns against Sequani. He's one of the kind of first victims of the SOCPA law. He's been sentenced to 4.5 years by a judge who is reported to be a fan of blood sports for his role in basically running a website and kind of organising protests where other people, not him, other people verbally abused, apparently, members or staff of Sequani. And just to kind of put that in context, like, I mean, there's a lot of kind of websites for him. If you go to the Anarchist Black Cross website, there's details there. And just in general, for writing to prisoners, there's a good PDF on the Antifa page, just talking about, like, basically how to do it, what to say, what not to say, because you can get them in trouble if you say the wrong things, kind of thing. But basically, if you want to write for him, it's Sean Kirtley, which is K-I-R-T-L-E-Y, and it's WC6977 HMP Stafford 60 Gale Road, G-A-O-L, Stafford, ST16-3AW. So yeah, I'm sure he'd like to hear you. Any messages of support, big or small. And like I said, all those details are on the Anarchist Black Cross website. Yeah, so the next interview is one that I did last night with Flo. I don't know. Not really introducing needed. She does it herself, really.
Hi, this is Patrick here for Distant Island, and I am talking with Flo.
Hello.
Do you want to start, Flo, by just telling us a little bit about who you are and what your background is?
Well, sure. I mean, I'll not go very deeply into my background because I suspect that your interest is with my legal background. But yeah. My name's Flo Krauss. I'm a barrister. I qualified in this country as a solicitor initially, and then I went to the bar, and I specialise in prisoners' rights. Which means, in effect, representing prisoners mostly in prison in front of parole boards, panels of the parole board, but also taking challenges through the administrative court, the private law court, and Strasbourg.
So, I mean, what is it about prisoners and about the prison system that fires you up so much?
You know, it's... I've always been sort of politically minded, and to me it's not just a legal battle, it's a political battle. And my personal view is that we actually don't need prisons. But of course, I have to operate within the legal system, and I have to operate within the prison system. And I'm trying within that system to make it as humane as possible. But also, my biggest battle is to make sure that I remain vigilant, and that there is somebody there to bear witness to what happens, because actually when they are behind their doors, when the guys have been put behind their doors, and I say the guys, but I mean the women as well, although there are fewer, you don't know what happens. Nobody knows what happens. And we need to know, and we need to be there, and we need to represent the voice of those who actually have been, you know, their voices have been taken away. Completely taken away, and that's not right. They've been thrown away from society. They don't matter. They don't exist. Only insofar as they're political sort of point scoring tools. And we have to. Somebody, somewhere has to represent their voice, and that's the job I've taken on.
In that, you kind of reject the whole idea of prisons. Do you have an alternative vision for instigating punishment, or do you think that the whole idea of punishment is wrong?
Yeah, I think the idea of punishment is wrong. I mean, obviously, it's difficult to argue when you're bringing kids up that, punishing them is wrong. You know, I've brought a child up myself and I have punished him. And I'm not sure that I like the idea, but I'm not sure I know an alternative. Mm-hmm. But I think when we're talking about adults, and the idea that the state punishes, I can't reconcile it with what the state should be doing. If there's got to be a state, the state is not there to punish. The state is not a parent. So I have problems with the idea of punishment. And of course, there's then the other aspect of it, which I think very few people know about, but there's been some research by a team of people on punishment. There's an article called The Neural Basis of Altruistic Punishment by about six different people. The reference is in Science, 27th of August 2004, volume 305, page 1254, if anybody's interested. And that's very interesting because it's basically confirming that there's an area in the brain which is activated when you're about to punish or when you meet that punishment, which provides you a lot of physical satisfaction akin to an orgasm. So then you start thinking about the idea of punishment in a whole new sort of dimension.
Yes.
And you think, well, something else is being gained here. You know, it's just not an objective concept.
Yeah, well, certainly the way it's kind of pursued by the state seems to be kind of quite fetishistic.
Oh, God, yeah.
Do you think that there can be any sort of rehabilitation within the current system?
Rehabilitation is a complete lip service concept. There is no such thing as rehabilitation currently in the prison system. Or in the probationary system. The only thing that is currently operated within probation, within prison, within parole board sort of decisions, within ministerial thinking, is control and punishment and protection of the public, the all-elusive concept of the public. I mean, you know, Labour's come in, has created over 6,000 new offences, has created ridiculous sentences like imprisonment for public protection, but what they've managed to do is make everybody dangerous.
I just wanted to ask you about life sentence prisoners. They're a particular kind of area of interest for you.
Yeah.
I mean, what is it about life sentence prisoners?
Well, let me tell you how that came in. You know, that when you commit an offence which attracts an indeterminate sentence, so basically, it's a bit complicated because they've introduced the imprisonment of public protection, but it works on the same principle. You get given a minimum period you must serve inside. Some people get given 6 months that they must serve inside as a minimum. Some people get given 30 years. Some people get given their whole life. So depending on the circumstances of the offence that you've committed, you will be given a minimum period to serve inside, and it's called a minimum term. Once that minimum term has expired, a panel of the parole board considers your suitability for release, which is why some people are given a minimum. I've got a client, for example, whose minimum term is 1 day, and he has spent 28 years in prison. So you can have people in prison for a number of years, so the minimum term is neither here nor there, in effect. So people don't understand that, and they think, well, you've been given 10 years, you come out after 10 years. No, you don't. You're at the mercy of the authorities and of whatever political current is going on. So if we're in an age of fear, as we are nowadays, and risk-averse sort of decision-making processes, nobody gets released. So my interest in life sentence prisoners is that actually the sentence itself and the nature of the sentence itself throws up a number of legal issues which are just ripe for challenging all the time. And somebody on license, so you're a life sentence prisoner, finally you manage to convince the authorities that you're safe to be released. You get released, but you're released on life license, which means that until you die, somebody can recall you to prison. Your probation officer gets a call one day that you were seen in the pub last night having an argument with someone. You will end up in prison for that until the authorities think that you are fit to be re-released. So you have no trial, you have no due process, nothing. Mm-hmm. And you are literally at the mercy of the state. Now, to me, there's something wrong with that, because basically it doesn't matter what they say when they say that your risk is low and you can now be released. What they're saying is you've done it once, you're going to do it again. You can never get away from it. So that's you know, there are a number of issues which are thrown up by the life sentence and the existence of the life license, more to the point, or the detention post tariff, which is the minimum period. So once your minimum term has expired, you're being detained because the authorities deem you to be too high a risk to be released. But actually, that's a very vague, very subjective concept, future dangerousness. So you're not held for anything, you know, not held in prison for anything you've done or for anything you should be punished about, but for something you might do in the future. That is so perverse.
I guess one of the kind of things that people might kind of say would be, I mean, what about people who genuinely are deigned?
Well, yeah, you're right. You know, there's no easy answer. We have to think as a group how we want to deal with people who threaten our, you know, sort of personal space and our personal integrity. Yeah, I agree with that. But then, you know, we only ever recognize crime in the sense of physical aggressions, you know, that sort of stuff. But that's not right. To me, that's not the right definition. You know, we have people who are in high position, who abuse their power all the time, who make other people's lives a fucking misery. But that's not considered a crime. You know, it's not about what people do, it's about a way of being, and it's about a way of being as a group. And we need to, of course it's a long haul, but we've got to start somewhere.
Yeah.
You know, it's a hugely difficult task, because the way we've built our society, we, in order to make it better and to make it a place where everybody actually has a voice and a space and the right to develop properly, we'd have to raise it down and start from scratch. So yes, it's a difficult question, but not an impossible one.
And, I mean, in your own work, do you ever feel that you are defending the indefensible sometimes?
No. No, because I'm not interested in whether they've done it or not done it. I'm not interested in whether they're a good person or a bad person. I'm not really interested in that. I'm interested in making sure that their rights are not trampled and that nobody pisses on their heads and tells them it's raining.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm interested in making sure that they are treated properly.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that might put you in the sights of Jack Straw as putting the needs of offenders before those of victims. I mean, how do you feel about being tarred with that brush?
You know, they're different needs. They're different needs altogether, so it's not about putting one before the other. Nobody gives a toss about prisoners. Only insofar as it gets them votes do they decide to bring it up. They are a complete political pawn. Nobody gives a toss. Victims get a fucking raw deal in the system as it works. But ultimately they have people's sympathy. You know, I have no feelings either way for victims. I'm not interested in the rights of victims because I don't think it's about rights. I think it's about something else. It's about allowing victims to go through a grieving process and a reparation process. I don't think it's about rights. It doesn't mean anything, the rights of the victim, the rights to what? To stone the offender to death. You know, it's not about rights, whereas somebody whose liberty is taken away. Now, that's a right. The right to liberty is a fundamental right. So it's very different. The right not to grieve is not a right. It's not a fundamental right, you know. The problem we've got is that victims who have had something dreadful happen to, you know, a lot of people have had awful experience. I mean, it's absolutely inhumane and dreadful. They haven't got the means to come to terms with it because of the system we live in. So now they've introduced, that the authorities have introduced, the right for victims or victims' families to come to parole board hearings to have a voice. Now picture this. Somebody, say Mr. X, kills Mrs. S. Mr. X gets given a tariff for 15 years. So he does his bird. After 15 years, the parole board says, right, we're going to consider whether you can be released. So they hold a hearing in the prison. Mr. S says, I want to come and say something about this. And the parole board says, yeah, all right then. You say, hold on a minute. I don't want you there. You've not been in touch for 15 years. You don't know the progress Mr. X has made. You don't know anything about what's happened. There's been absolutely no restorative justice. There's been absolutely no attempt by anybody to make you come face to face. This is not the right forum. This is his day. It's Mr. X's day for release and whatever consideration. It is not your day. This is, you know, this is a completely different matter. Now, if at the point of sentencing, they had, for example, said, right, well, are you willing to engage in a restorative justice process? And the parties may say no because it's too fresh in their minds, they're too anxious, they're too scared, they're too hurt, they, you know, fair enough, they're too distressed. But it's something that should be on the table throughout to enable the parties to come to some sort of humane resolution between them. There would be no need for the victims to come to parole board hearings. But nothing happens. So you want to hear what the victims have to say at those hearings. They say, he's evil, he's dangerous. When he did this 15 years ago, he was like this, he was like... They have no idea who the man is now. They don't know who they're talking about. They haven't been given a chance to move on. And it's hard to move on when you've been hit by something as dreadful as the death of a loved one, you know, in awful, horrific circumstances. Or when you've been yourself the subject of a very violent crime, it's very hard to move on. We have to, and it's not a right, but we have to give that, the means to people to move on for both sides. And we have to stop seeing it in terms of the rights of victim and such a polarized debate.
So this is kind of an alternative to actually using punishment.
Well, I don't know that it would go down so well if that was suggested. But certainly restorative justice is a fantastic way of giving people the chance to move on a humane level, you know, just so that you can continue with your life as well as possible from both sides.
Yeah.
Never mind what else happens, you know, around, but at least unlock the emotions.
Okay, Flo, thanks a lot for coming in and talking to us.
And, well, thank you for asking.
And, yeah, good luck with all your work.
Antisocial Behaviour Orders were a part of the Crime and Disorder Act 1998 and came into force on April 1st, 1999. Since later modified by the Police Reform Act 2002 and the Antisocial Reform Act 2003, orders can prevent individuals from entering certain areas for a minimum of 2 years. An application for an ASBO can be made by police, local authorities, housing action trusts and registered social landlords. The culprit must be deemed to be guilty of an antisocial behaviour, defined on the Government Guide to ASBOs as
behaviour which causes or is likely to cause harassment, alarm or distress to one or more people who are not in the same household as a perpetrator.
In the application process for an ASBO, there is no jury and hearsay evidence is admissible. ASBOs can be known as CRASBOs if they are an order made on conviction in criminal proceedings. So this name is misleading, as all ASBOs and CRASBOs are civil orders. And if you break your ASBO, you run the risk of a maximum of 5 years in jail. December 2004. Between April 1999 and December 2004, 4,649 ASBOs were issued in England and Wales, and that number rose by over 100% by the end of 2005 to 9,853. Weighing in with the least ASBOs is Wiltshire, I'm not even sure where that is, with 56, Lincolnshire with 60. Okay, top end of the scale, we have London, of course, with 1,541, and Manchester weighing in with a significant 1,464. Asbos have been given to two teenage boys from Manchester, and they are banned from wearing one golf glove. A 17-year-old can't say grass to mean snitch or rat. A 15-year-old bald boy can't play footy on his own road. An 18-year-old can't congregate with more than three youths and was arrested for entering a youth centre. I should have said and before the last one, because that was the last one.
My personal favourite is the pirate radio station DJ who can no longer go above sixth floor in a building. So I'm just gonna do a little plug here for something that's happening in Lark on the 10th of November. It's remembering Ken Sarawiwa and the Ogoni 9, 13 years on. So yeah, like I said, it's here in Lark, which is 5262 Fieldgate Street in Whitechapel. And it's basically kind of films and music and all the rest of it, about kind of what happened to Ken Sarawiwa. So next up, we have the last interview from the show tonight, which was done for Casper, done by Casper, for us. This is Casper's first contribution to Dissin' Ireland, and in interview form. And, he was talking to Anna, who participated in the No 2 Data Retention Conference that I think happened in Bucharest, somewhere in Eastern Europe anyway. I'm sure she'll tell us. And then after the interview, we're going to be going into Kevin's set. So, thanks for listening and stay tuned.
If you feel like your working and private life is becoming more like a prison, with both the state and companies as your guards, you might be interested in this. On a European level, governments, especially Britain, are pushing for the EU Directive 2006/24/EC to force ISPs to retain data effectively monitoring and mapping their clients' activities on the internet. I met up with one of the administrators of Activix.org. Hi Margarita, thanks for coming.
Thanks for inviting me.
We're here to talk about the data retention laws and kind of what it means for activists and other people, of course. And first of all, could you please introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about what you're doing?
Okay. Yeah, I'm one of the administrators of this server called Activix. We provide email addresses, mailing lists, and very few simple websites. We provide them for free. We are all volunteers, so we provide them to volunteers, activists, groups. The legislation has not been approved yet. It's scheduled to be voted, I believe, in January 2009. However, some countries have already made that law into their national laws, and in some other countries, like the UK, the cut-off deadline is, I believe, about March 2009. One reason why this law, I don't see it as having chance to be very challenged, is that the information that the governments want is not what is written on emails, what is talked about, or what is said in phone conversations. It is not that it is that they're after. Thereafter, for example, for telephone companies, I mean, for telephone calls, they want the number that a person dials, the number from where, I mean, the number from where it is dialed, name and an address of the person making the call, name and address of the person receiving the call, how long it lasts, and the means of the call. Is it from? Is it using a mobile phone? Is it using a normal landline? Is it using VoIP or anywhere? You know, what is the technology that is used? Is it an encrypted call, which can be as well? Is it not? For email communications, they want again name and address of the email that is sent. For email communications, they would be after the name and address of the person sending the email, the name and address of the person receiving the email, the time, the subject line, and the technology used to send that email. Again, is it, the communication channels by which these emails are sent. For that, they can use the server that hosts that email service, in this case would be ActiveX, or the internet service provider that the person is paying for the internet connection. But that is the kind of data that the government wants. So it is very difficult to argue for a violation of privacy because they are not after the contents of the communication. They are after basically the networks. Who are you related to? How often do you email or phone this person? All this fits in all the other data gathering that the government has, at the reach of their hands. Every time, as some of us already know, every time you get on a bus with an Oyster card or you get on the tube, your movements are recorded. Some of us have taken the precaution of having an anonymous Oyster card, of not using a credit card with it ever, or debit card, always paying with cash. Every time you make a payment with your debit card, every time you withdraw money from your bank, all that, you are virtually every step on your life is recorded somewhere. Companies do get hold of that information. It is information that is very valuable to sell to advertising companies or to all sorts of agencies. And it is already known, and I think at least some of us do have that, you know, in our consciousness that, it's not about being paranoid, it's just being conscious, right, this, you know, the fact that I am in this location at this time, in this day, and I'm getting out money out of this cashier that is in this place, it is recorded somewhere. And then you make a decision. Well, I'm not sure if that consciousness is kind of transposed to when you make a phone call or when you send an email. We have to have the same consciousness that nothing that we do with a computer is anonymous. It is not anonymous. Even if you open a Hotmail account, especially if you open a Google account, it is not anonymous. And when you send an email, it is very likely, unless you know how to read the information that the techies know how to read. Most probably, what is called the IP address, you know, the address basically from where you are sending stuff is recorded on that address, on that email. And if the other person responds to your email, then their address is also going to be recorded. Now, some people are already taking precautions like encrypted on all their emails, which is not a straightforward process, but it should be seen as basically closing your letters. If your employer sends you, say, your salary notification, they don't send you a postcard, they send you a letter that is sealed. And then if it is open, there is outrage because someone has been looking through your mail. So encryption plays that role of closing your letters. Okay, encryption is not enough because what many agencies, the government and the police and all sorts of people that we don't know because we don't know their faces, what they are interested in is not in the actual wording of our emails, of our communications, is who we are networking with. If the government, if the police wanted to know who you have been communicating with before 2001, and I do know that this happened. They would have to go to activists or to any person's home, confiscate the computer, and look who that person had been emailing to. And I know that has happened. If they pass a law by which internet service providers, i.e. companies or small service providers like ourselves, they only have to go to this in order to gather that information. They don't even know to let the person know that their data is being gathered. And again, well, it is usually a lot easier to convince a company if you are the police, it is a lot easier to convince a company, look, we need this information for terrorist purposes, please give it to us, than to convince an activist, look, give us your computer. So if you have a law that makes it compulsory for companies to gather all that data, then that process is no longer necessary. So that is one big objective of the law as well. It is also a way of ensuring that they have this information. Because, I mean, if you are a careful activist, you are not going to be storing emails from, say, 1 or 2 years ago, or you are probably going to go somewhere else to send your emails. Again, well, that would be a way of circumventing this law as well. But if you are careful enough, if you are using your computer at home, but if you are regularly deleting your emails, if your internet service provider has got the obligation to store your emails or store your communications, you know, the data that they store for 2 years, then it doesn't matter if you delete them from your computer. They are still available in wherever they have to be, which is not yet decided. But they are still available for the police, for the government, or even for another company if they want to buy this kind of data, which is information. Any information is always, it always has the risk to become commercialized. Yeah, okay. There is going to be a law by which ISPs, internet service providers, are going to be obliged to store this information. However, it is a fact that ISPs are already storing this information. As I said, it is important to store information that allows you to troubleshoot problems. So this law is kind of important. It's a landmark in the lawmaking process, in a way, for governments. But for ordinary people, it is not going to change things that much because, internet service providers, even activists, we do store some information already. In activists, we try not to store it for any longer than is necessary. I don't think we keep logs for much longer than a week. It's just strictly for troubleshooting, and you know, our users can have the confidence that if, say, an order comes to Actrix asking for any information, we are always going to ask for a warrant, okay? But for, like, your normal internet service provider that provides you with your broadband service, they are not going to have that stance, and chances are that they are already storing that information. So the only change that the law is going to make is that, you know, we are going to know if it gets passed, and if it gets passed in the same terms that the directive is currently wording, it will probably mean that big ISPs will store the data for at least 6 months and for at most 2 years. Right now, big corporations, big ISPs, are storing the data, and we have no idea if they are storing it for less than 6 months or for more than 2 years or for 10 years. We have no idea. We have the suspicion that it is not going to be for much longer than 2 years, because storing information, although it may seem in our computers that it is something ethereal, it actually requires space, apart from electricity. But, some ISPs have made some calculations, and you actually need quite a lot of hard drives to store all your users, all this information that the government is going to want stored for a few years. It's a lot of cost. So yeah, the big internet service providers have been lobbying the government so that this does not become a law. But of course, their only criteria is the cost that this is going to mean for them. is not about people's privacy or anything like that. That is something that some of the smaller ISPs are arguing. But it has to be like taken into account that internet service providers, especially not just the email providers, but also the broadband or data providers, they are already storing this information, and this will only mean that we will know what period and in what circumstances this data can be like shared with agencies or with companies. Yeah, okay. There is going to be a law by which ISPs, internet service providers, are going to be obliged to store this information. However, it is a fact that ISPs are already storing this information. As I said, it is important to store information that allows you to troubleshoot problems. Now, I have... Most... you can choose... Sorry. Right. No, I'm thinking as well.
Are storing the data already?
I was just, trying to make your editing process more easy. Okay. So this law is kind of important. It's a landmark in the lawmaking process, in a way, for governments. But for ordinary people, it is not going to change things that much. Because, internet service providers, even activists, we do store some information already. In activists, we try not to store it for any longer than is necessary. I don't think we keep logs for much longer than a week. It's just strictly for troubleshooting, and our users can have the confidence that if, say, an order comes to activists asking for any information, we are always going to ask for a warrant. Okay, but for like your normal internet service provider that provides you with your broadband service, they are not going to have that stance, and chances are that they are already storing that information. So the only change that the law is going to make is that we are going to know if it gets passed, and if it gets passed in the same terms that the directive is currently wording, it will probably mean that big ISPs will store the data for at least 6 months and for at most 2 years. Right now, big corporations, big ISPs, are storing the data, and we have no idea if they are storing it for less than 6 months or for more than 2 years or for 10 years. We have no idea. We have the suspicion that it is not going to be for much longer than 2 years, because storing information, although it may seem in our computers that it is something ethereal, it actually requires space, apart from electricity. But, some ISPs have made some calculations, and you actually need quite a lot of hard drives to store all your users, all this information that the government is going to want stored for a few years. It's a lot of cost. So, yeah, the big internet service providers have been lobbying the government so that this does not become a law. But of course, their only criteria is the cost that this is going to mean for them. It's not about people's privacy or anything like that. That is something that some of the smaller ISPs are arguing. But it has to be like taken into account that internet service providers, especially not just the email providers, but also the broadband or data providers, they are already storing this information, and this will only mean that we will know what period and in what circumstances this data can be like shared with agencies or with companies. But right now, pretty much, people should be aware that all their information, all their communication, all the information that relates to their communications is pretty much in the open, and anyone can see it.
A small success yesterday when the German Constitutional Court ruled certain aspects of a national version of the EU Directive 2006/24/EC illegal. However, FIBA no means safe, and if you want to find out more about autonomous email services, then look up the list of ISPs who signed the campaign against data retention at www.activix.org. That's A-K-T-I-V-I-X.org.
Okay, sounds of Dissident Island here, coming out from East London through the airwaves. The live tracks you've been listening to tonight have been from Reknor and Siren Party on the 18th of October. Live recordings, they were Interterrestrials with Noah's Farce, then Kilner Boy with Wally's Bar, and then King Blues with The Landlord's Song. Right, this is, just so you're aware, this is Crap Law number 3047, The Protection of a Rex Order, note 2003. So, modern law here. You are not allowed to enter the hull of a Titanic without permission from the Secretary of State. So remember that, okay? All you wreck creepers out there. Right, next up we got Self-Funk Set from Kevin.
Thanks a lot, John. I'm going to kick off. Thanks for giving me this opportunity, by the way, because it's not often I get to play this great music out, but it's in celebration of a lot of things and in celebration of the Panthers that are over at the moment. I'm going to kick off with a version of Marvin Gaye's Right On, and it's by the Sons of Slum.
Baby, it's all right.
Yeah, nice one. Next up is Betty Levette. A lot of Panthers joined the Black Panther Party when they were young. A lot of them were between the ages of 14, 19. And they were asking themselves some pretty serious questions as young men and women in the areas that they were in. And this record is for all of them who made that jump across and became activists.
Woke up this morning with the sun down shining in. Found my mind in a brown paper bag within. Tripped on a cloud, fell 8 miles high. Tore my mind on a jagged sky. Hey, I dropped in, see your condition, my condition. Deep drop hole, and then I follow it in.
disregard the Constitution, then we can clean up all the mind pollution. Put an end
to all discrimination. Only then can we rebuild this nation.
Can't sleep in the street no more.
No, no.
Can't keep hanging around, around, around. My family has deserted me, and my conscience calling me. Oh, down, 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 down. I'm so hip for politics. I'm an honest soul.
Everybody on the
stand up and be counted. Peace and freedom.
Miriam Makeba with Do You Remember Malcolm? Before that you heard Ghetto Kitty with Stand Up and Be Counted. This next one is a bit of jazz, and it's a little Scottish connection here. This is for all the Miscarriages of Justice organisation people up in Glasgow, and it's a piece of Gil Scott-Heron I'm going to play. And of course we know that Gil Scott-Heron's father played for Glasgow Celtic in the 50s, and he was called the Black Arrow, so this is for him.
Finest
shadows cast by rainbows, there you'll meet the sage. Feeding rabbits bits of lettuce or cleaning out the cage. He can give you more direction than you've ever known. Show you your bronze baby shoes now, my how you have grown. Ain't it nice to fly? You're waving as soft clouds go by, but peace won't be still of its own free will. Say you want to go exploring, you got to find some truth. You can't stand one more day of Christians shouting down at you. You say you don't dig politics, that never was your bag. People who could run for office wave their private flag. Ain't it nice to fly? You're waving as all clouds go by, but peace won't be still of its own free will.
Fantastic, Gil Scott Heron, and a track called Free Will. I mentioned Curtis Mayfield before, one of the most influential soul artists of all time, and when you hear this, I think it's a good illustration of why he's held in such high esteem, is his classic We People Who Are Darker Than Blue. I'll tell the whole story.
feel sad? Shall we commit our own genocide before you check out your mind? I know we've all got problems, that's why I'm here to say, keep peace with me and I with you. Let me love in my own way.
People Who Are Darker Than Blue by Curtis Mayfield. And then next up, this is for all the sisters involved with the activism surrounding the campaign to free the Angola Three and Zulu. To all of you, this is the Queen of Soul, Aretha Franklin, with Soulville.
Yeah, I'm on short wave.
Yeah, that's Aretha Franklin and Soulville. The next tune up is a piece of New Orleans funk soul from Lee Dorsey. Lee Dorsey, and who's going to help brother get further? Here's another piece of Curtis Mayfield.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, the Bitter End is proud to present Curtis Mayfield. We're killing up our leaders.
what's wrong, young. But who's gonna fight to make it right? Am I the body? Spray the whitey. Your black and white power. It's gonna be a crumbling tower. And we will stand the fight. So goddamn undecided. Give this some thought. And stupidness we've all been called. You're gonna bleed. Can I get a bit deeper? May I get a bit deeper? Say I get a bit deeper. Human life is from the seed.
Curtis Mayfield. classic Mighty Mighty Spade and Whitey from his classic live album. This is Grady Tate with Be Black. Thank you. Yeah, that's a slice of New Orleans funk there from, oh my goodness, from early in the top notes, it's Dap Walk. And here's another piece of New Orleans funk by Chuck Carbo. Can I Be Your Squeeze by Chuck Carbo, and that's for Herman, Albert and Zulu down in Angola prison in Louisiana. Hold tight, brothers.
Hey!
good. That's Soul Shake from Jojo Benson and Peggy Scott, and there's some shaking going on here at Lark as well, I can tell you. This next tune is for Billy X Jennings and Emory Douglas, who are over here at the moment, and this is a message to all young people out there who might think they want to get involved with activism. This is by George Soule. It's called Get Involved.
Speaking out. Hey, y'all, stand up right now and start running your mouth. Tell them about it. You keep talking about the world and that we need a change. Dadgummy, all you do is sit on your you-know-what and never do a thing.
That's George Soule with Get Involved, and I'm coming up to my last track now, and I just want to say before this last track, thanks to the people at Lark and thanks to everybody from Distant Radio for letting us play some great soul music for you tonight. I'm going to finish with a tune from Philadelphia, and being that that's the home where the cracked Liberty Bell is housed and everything, and also I'm going to send this out to Mumia Abu-Jamal, who was the voice of the voiceless as a journalist for the MOVE organization in Philadelphia for many years, and I think some of you may know about his story, and the MOVE story as well is quite incredible, and a radio show all in itself, I might suggest, for the future. But yeah, this is for the MOVE organization, for Ramona Africa, and for Mumia Abu-Jamal, the brother there in SCI Green Prison, still on death row. This is for you. It's a great bringing the soul up to date with a slice of Philadelphia funk and hip-hop, and it's from the Roots. Good night.
she don't want no rock and roll. She want platinum or icy gold, gold with a whole lot of something to fold. If you were obstacles, you cold drop me cold, cause one mug it don't stop the show. Little hair is bad, in these streets she done ran ever since when the heat began. I told a girl, look here, fall back, let me hold your hand. I'll enable you to keep the plan. Things quick we learn, and we can make money to burn. If you allow me to lay this game, I don't ask for much, only the room to spread my wings. In the world finna know my nine, it's a time. Just to let you know. Yeah.
when the mighty rules rule. This is how it's going down. Worldwide. Smith at work in the building right about now. We like to call this getting it in. Y'all gonna don't talk back. Check it out, man. Alright. Yeah, the Curve Douglas on guitar, man.
Everybody, I'm a son of a gun. Black master of any trade under the sun. talk sharp like a razor blade under the tongue. Clear my path and come get your cat that hung. Wanna breathe like black or collapse your lung. Young chump, you can choke off the web I spun. I done cleared them out with the bread I brought. You done heard about what set I'm from. My nigga, word of mouth, little rule of thumb. Y'all better bow down, hear the rule of come. I'm a legend in the hood, not a who to love. How far, put it down, be confusing some of y'all cats. Can't walk while chewing your gumming on what? Keyboard, gotta do with a drumming on. School them on stage like I'm doing a seminar. Professional type, I'm adjusting my mic. Go to war, son, I give you any weapon you like. Bust off your thumb dogs, it's something to run from. Stop it, the hot shit here's where we come from. Philly worldwide phenomenon. Reinforcing that thing's my 9 to 5. When I'm finished making them recognize, we getting at a few civilized women who trying to ride. Well, you been waiting on the boys, looking for them for all. You wanna get the joints up off the wall. Just to see you smile and enjoy yourself. Keeping you in health is for all of y'all. I'm quick on the draw like Black McGraw. Can't tell what y'all cats rap before. My name, Reed Keys, and I'm back for more. See me getting more chips than a corner store. Got a portrait of Malcolm X on the door. And I'm eating MCs like a corner war. Matter of fact, he's back when you get hard. Bring the warning horn when I'm going to perform. The first thing to move or disturb the rules. I'ma have y'all blitz on the evening news. Play y'all ball, get on y'all P's and Q's. And when y'all think for, be prepared to lose. And bring money to spend and some money to live. It's a worthwhile money, not 20 to 10. Get took when you tuck right in front of your head. Who could've helped you, man? Not none of your friends. Cause I put a black fist under your chin. Had your physical remains found under my pen. If I'm coming up in the place, I'm coming to rent. 1 in 4 minutes, now I'm coming again. 3 G's, I talk and chat, but y'all please receive. When I'm gonna get back to y'all, please. Cause you don't really wanna get clapped with all these. My man, you can take y'all's crap when y'all leave. You see the squad coming to place, they all freeze. Ice cold, with his mellow cool breeze. MC's never showed loyalty yet. Cool hurt, ain't never get a royalty check. I do work, no work, then I'm on your set. Gone collect, and sharp like my name Gillette. R.I.P. my name Gillette. Till I touch the mic, y'all people ain't seen danger yet. But I'm a decorated vet, who regulated red. I never hesitated yet, I get a heavyweight check. When you the dare ask, am I dedicated? Yes, I spit loud rounds, it'll penetrate a vest. Yo, take your seats, I'm a demonstrator test. I'd freak the beat, so gangsta fresh. It's dumb, from the East Coast to Bangladesh. Big bang, really back up the bank. Hold tight, cause it ain't over yet. I don't even feel like I'm not sober yet. And it rains like shots in the projects. New Year's Eve, and it ain't even October yet. When I'm a big down, I'm gonna like Boba Fett. Y'all most shell shocked in a soldier yet. If the prize in my sights, I'ma go for this. Whoop, whoop, yo, the roots is the ultimate. I'm a culprit, give me the bulk shit. Cause I'ma set it on a magnetic coach tip. Get down how I'm supposed to get. I got nothing to lose when I'm killing it with no regrets. Like LLL, cause I'm hard as hell. Make the niggas screw face like Gargamel. Now we all out on our own like Patti LaBelle. I put the best game down. I hope you're mad about that, but come on, good. Yeah, man at work. Man at work. Yeah, y'all.
Now.
What?
You in my hood now.
What?
You in my hood now.
I house you.
You in my hut now.
Come on.
You in my hut now.
Come on.
You in my hut now.
What? Come on.
You in my hut now.
In my hut.
You in my hut now.
Uh-huh.
You in my hut now.
Uh-huh.
You in my hut now.
Uh-huh.
You in my hut.